Welcome to Earth Matters. This is Donna Stevens, Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and your host for today's program on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU, at 89.1 FM. Today's show is about birds of the Cliff Gila Valley along the Gila River and how a river diversion could impact their diversity and populations. So although today's show is nominally about birds, it's really more about habitats and ecology, since you can't separate a species from its habitat. Joining me here in the studio is ornithologist and naturalist Mike Fugali. He knows an enormous amount about the ecology of the Gila Valley. He's lived there for many, many years. So good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Donna.
Thanks for joining me here. So first of all, I just want to make one small comment to make sure listeners know the area that we're talking about when we say the Cliff Gila Valley. So we're talking about the Gila River near the towns of Gila and Cliff, downstream of the Gila Wilderness area. And Mike, I wondered if you could start by just giving us a kind of general lay of the land in the valley, what it's like.
Sure. The Cliff Gila Valley is the first broad alluvial floodplain that the Gila River spills out into once it leaves its stronghold up in the Gila National Forest and Wilderness areas. It's approximately a 14-mile-long valley, starting at the Gila Upper Box and flowing down through the towns of Cliff and Gila and Riverside, all the way to the Gila National Forest bird habitat area before it enters the middle box. So the Gila River in New Mexico is sort of like a necklace. It's a series of narrow box canyons joined by broad river valleys. So it's the Upper Box and the Gila Valley, the Middle Box, the Red Rock Valley, the Lower Box, the Verdon Valley, and then the Arizona border.
So can you explain what the Upper Box and the Middle Box, where those are?
Sure. Those box canyon stretches of the river are narrow stretches of the river, you know, confining the river by steep canyon walls. The valley reaches of the river are very different ecologically than the narrow canyon stretches of the river. The narrow canyon stretches of the river are areas that are naturally channelized. And the valley stretches of the river, like the Cliff Gila Valley, are essentially energy release valves. So when you have big floods like we had in 2005, near 30,000 cubic feet per second, it's in those valley reaches that waters are able to well up, spread out, releasing the energy and providing the opportunity for the creation of a whole host of very unique and important habitat types.
So in the Box Canyon areas, they're confined by rock walls and they can't really go anywhere?
That's right. It's sort of like water down through a narrow pipe. And when you have high energy flows, you have no opportunity to disperse that energy like you do in valley reaches. And so you always end up naturally with catastrophic scouring. And so the biodiversity in those narrow canyon stretches is not as pronounced as you'd have in the broad valley reaches.
Okay, that kind of leads me to my next question about the habitats that we have in the broad valley section. So I know you can't really talk about birds with talking about the plants, the plant communities where they occur, and the types of habitats. So can you talk a little bit about the different habitats that are in the valley?
Sure. Probably the most important habitat that we're interested in and that supports a lot of these rare and unique bird communities are the riparian forests, the cottonwood willow forests. And these forests are really interesting and unique in that they developed, or they started to develop 250 million years ago when woody vegetation first started to spread over the Earth's land surface. And over time, cottonwood willow forests have evolved to have a root structure, an above-ground architecture, and particularly a reproductive strategy that allows them to successfully hold loose alluvial soils in place so that when you do have catastrophic flooding events, you don't end up with the kind of catastrophic scouring that you would have had prior to the development of those sorts of forest systems on the planet. And so in the Cliff Gila Valley, what that means is that adjacent to the river corridor, for a particular width outward of a couple hundred meters, you have a, of a what we call a riparian forest. These are trees that have very shallow root systems that depend on having their feet in water. And then as you move further out across the floodplain, you'll run into a whole lot of different habitat types, like semi-riparian forests made up of other trees, like walnuts and hackberries and ash trees, trees that still have a lot of water requirements, but they don't have anywhere near the requirements that the riparian trees have closer to the river corridor. Also on the floodplain, you have historically, before agricultural development of the floodplain, you would have had lots of floodplain grasslands, wet meadows, mesquite bosques, places like that, all important for bird communities.
So for the cottonwoods, I understand that they're seeds are only viable for maybe 5 or 6 weeks in the spring, and that they've kind of co-evolved to for their seeds to fall at the time when the river would be flooding and when there would be muddy areas from spring runoff. Is that right?
That's right. A cottonwood seed is only viable for a short period of time, and what it's looking for during that time period is a moist sandbar or mud flat, generally associated with receding spring floodwaters. And if it doesn't find that, it's not going to germinate, and it hardly ever finds that in most years. The conditions have to be just right. And when you do have a germination event, you'll have a lot of trees seeded at the exact same time along a long longitudinal axis parallel to the river corridor. And so you end up with something that we call a stringer, a long linear line of even-aged cottonwoods. And if you look out across a floodplain, you can clearly see a series of different age stringers, and you can say there's the 1967 flood, the 1976 flood, the 1992 flood, et cetera.
I've been out on the river when you've said things like that, and it's always kind of amazed me. So would you just have to know, like you'd have to live there to know that that's when those trees germinated, or
right,
is there some other way?
I suppose you could, you know, do a cross-section of the tree and actually age them, but
yeah.
In general, I've lived on the river for, about 15 years now, and I've seen quite a few germination events take place. A lot of them don't hold because they happen so close to the river corridor that the big floods come along and take those newly sprouted seedlings and saplings away. But sometimes they survive. There's enough time between catastrophic events, and you end up with a mature stringer developing.
Yeah, look, that's cool. So of the more than 500 species of birds that have been verified to occur in New Mexico, I was reading up for this interview, and I see that about 330 species of those birds have been observed in the valley. And I wonder if you could tell us why bird species diversity is so high there.
For a couple of different reasons, I think. You have to think about first what the valley is and also where it is. In terms of where it is, the Gila region is at a crossroads for biological diversity, and not just for birds, but in almost all taxonomic groups. For instance, we have four species of skunk here, which is a little bit funny. And so what we are, we're at the intersection of a number of different ecoregions. And so those ecoregions interdigitate in this area. We have the Sierra Madrean ecoregion coming up from the south, the Rocky Mountain ecoregion coming down from the north, and then we have both the Sonoran and Chihuahuan desert ecoregions coming in from the west and east, respectively. And so each one of those ecoregions provides different kinds of diversity that all mix together in this region, giving us a whole lot of things. Also, maybe an overused quote now, but I still always use it whenever I give a talk. It's Lauren Isley's famous quote that if there is magic on this planet, it is contained in water. You know, we live in a very arid region, and if you look at the Cliff Gila Valley on Google Earth, looking at it down from high above, you'll see that it is an island of lush green broadleaf riparian habitat that really sits in a sea of very, very arid landscapes, and to the north also pine forests up in the forest. So that's where the water is, and so that's the building block of life, of all life, and so that's why there's so many species there.
Yeah, it seems a little funny to me that we, in such an arid environment as southwest New Mexico, that we seem to have historically not that much regard for water and for our streams and rivers. I mean, I know this is slightly off topic, but last week I was hiking along San Vicente Creek just south of Silver City and downstream of Silver City, and there's so much garbage in it. It's just amazing to me. I just think, this is water. And, you know, people like to say, well, you know, we all have to have water, and yet this is how we treated it, with such utter disregard and disrespect. I just find it amazing that that's what we've done.
That's true. I think also another quote from, I think it was Luna Leopold, that the health of our waters is the principal measure of how we live on the land.
Yes.
I think that is a very appropriate quote.
I think so, too. Can you tell us how you think the valley has changed in the 100-plus years since it was settled by Europeans and they began agriculture in the valley?
Sure. The late 19th century and the 20th century were pretty tough times for the Gila River. There were lots of changes both to the river corridor and the floodplain in the Cliff Gila Valley, but also to the larger watershed above that area. In the 1870s, I think, is when the first real push for grazing came into the area. We poured lots of cattle and sheep out onto the landscape with no real ecological understanding of our native bunch grass ecosystems. And very quickly, by the end of the 1870s, most of our grasslands in the area were pretty well degraded. And then in the 1880s, something else happened that people didn't have experience with or an understanding of. We had our first decadal drought set in post-European settlement. And by the end of the 1880s, they said you could have thrown a rock from carcass to carcass, from Texas to California. But the damage was done, and there wasn't a lot of healthy grasslands left on the landscape. Then at the turn of the 20th century, the rains returned. And we had catastrophic erosive events. And, of course, that's where we got our big ditch from here in Silver City. The watershed surrounding Silver City was in such horrible condition that the ditch, the main street, was scoured away into a 40-foot chasm. Down in the valley itself, we had really unfettered grazing on the river corridor. And young cottonwood and willow seedlings and saplings are just like cotton candy. And they're always the first things to go. And so when we did have large-scale flooding events, there wasn't enough vegetative friction on the floodplain to really absorb that energy and allow those waters to spread out softly across the floodplain. So instead, we ended up with a lot of catastrophic scouring along the river channel. And we also had a lot of river-evulsive events where the river would jump the channel or carve itself a broad, shallow channel. It would take away a lot of agricultural land. And in response to the fear of land loss in the valley, we ended up with levee construction throughout the Cliff Gila Valley. And essentially when they built those levees, what they did was they turned a valley section of the river and all those wonderful ecological properties that are associated with valley reaches into a canyon reach, an artificial canyon reach, bounded instead of by cliffs but by levees on both sides. Mm-hmm. And in response to that, what we ended up with was channel incision, more catastrophic scouring within the levee borders. And so the cottonwood willow forest throughout much of the 20th century was very degraded. And we are now in a period, thankfully, of recovery in response to the levee systems no longer being maintained and also much less grazing on the river corridor. It's important to note that it is an agricultural valley primarily, and so most of the floodplain has been laser leveled, and most of it is used using gravity-fed acequia systems as the irrigation method, as permanent pasture for beef cattle. So a lot of water is withdrawn through the acequia system, reducing base flows in the river for much of the year.
Let's talk about that some more after we come back from the break. Stay with us, please. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. If you're just joining us, I'm Donna Stevens from the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. Joining me here in the studio in beautiful downtown Silver City is ornithologist and naturalist Mike Fugale. And we are talking about the Gila River Valley, the Cliff Gila Valley, and how it has changed over the years since people have settled it, since Europeans have settled in the late 1800s. And right before the break, we were talking about the levees that have been constructed for agriculture in the valley. And I wanted to ask you how you think these changes in the valley have affected the plants and the animals that live there, that lived there in the valley before this agriculture took hold.
Well, in terms of bird communities in particular, you know, there used to be a continuity of habitats from upland habitats down to the river corridor. And of course, now in the valley, you have a fairly well-developed cottonwood forest along the river corridor, but then you have a break in native habitats between the river corridor and the uplands. Essentially, that's where the pastures exist. And so birds no longer can move freely from upland to riparian areas. And I think that those missing habitats, like the mesquite bosques that used to occur on the floodplain edges and the broad floodplain grasslands and wet meadows, a lot of backwater oxbow areas, those types of habitats are just missing. And so the birds that really utilized those areas are also either diminished or missing from the system.
Did you just say, Mike, that birds have a hard time moving from the upland habitats down to the river?
Well, birds do have wings and they do things, but they don't necessarily want to cross. If you're a summer tanager or a yellow-billed cuckoo or a southwestern willow flycatcher, you're not necessarily interested in moving across a pasture filled with cool season grasses to get up to the edge of the floodplain, for instance, where there might be mesquite bosques filled with insects and other prey items.
I think that people have the opinion that because birds can fly, they can just pretty much go anywhere they want. But you're saying that that's not necessarily true, that there's other forces at work here besides the fact that they can fly.
Right. Not only, you know, they have flight, but they have to have somewhere to fly to or a reason to fly.
Right.
I think I heard on the radio this morning that the Audubon Society just came out with a new report today suggesting that climate changes in the 21st century are imperiling almost half of North America's birds, possibly to the point of extinction. That is not due to the fact that we're taking their wings away. It's due to the fact that the habitats that have the right humidities and temperatures and so forth that those birds need to survive are no longer going to be present on the North American continent.
Yeah, I got that email this morning, too, from a local Audubon member, and it was not a very nice way to wake up, I'll have to say, because you know, I mean, birds are lovely, and I'm definitely not an ornithologist, but I love to watch them, and it's very sad to think that half of them are endangered due to human activities. And that kind of leads me to another question, which is I've kind of heard the opinion from many people about, well, why does it matter if we don't have this particular species or, you know, why do we need so many species of mosquitoes or things that we don't really like very much? Why are they important? So why are they important? I mean, who cares if we don't have, say, a southwest willow flycatcher? There's other flycatchers. Why is this one so important? And what difference does it make if they're not here?
Right. That's the age-old conservation question, I guess. You know, another way to frame that question is, what good are they?
Right.
What good are they anyway? And, you know, most environmental philosophers, when they're faced with that question, like to turn it on its head. And they usually ask the questioner, well, what good are you?
Right. That's an unpopular question.
Right. What good am I? And so really, you know, I'll freely admit that the feathers of the yellow-billed cuckoo probably do not harbor a secret cure for an obscure cancer. These birds are existing for their own sake. And I think that ultimately, this comes down to an ethical question. You know, when Elder Leopold shot that wolf and saw the fierce green fire in its eyes, you know, we all ask ourselves, well, what does that fierce green fire really represent?
Right.
And to me, I read that as the will to live. I spent a decade studying a very small songbird out in Southern California called the California gnatcatcher. And after a decade, you know, working with that bird and considering its life, I was absolutely convinced that, you know, that bird had a right to carry on its evolutionary journey because it also shared with me the same will to live that I do. So I think the answer to that question basically comes down to the golden rule.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think there's something else, too, besides just ethics at play. There's also, what Aldo Leopold said, the first law of intelligent tinkering is to save all the parts. Like, all right, I'll just go out on a limb and embarrass myself here. Many, many years ago, I was driving my old car down the highway, and in my rearview mirror, I see a belt rolling away from my car, and everything seemed fine. I mean, my car kept going, and I definitely am not an auto mechanic, and I had no idea what that belt did, and so I just kept going. I didn't know what else to do. And later on, it turns out, my car began to drive only on three of its four cylinders. And I realized, oh, you know, I think that belt actually was doing something, even if I didn't understand it. And I think that's also true with all the species in our ecosystems. They have some function that we perhaps don't understand, but we don't know what we can safely get rid of and what we can't safely get rid of.
That's true. And I, you know, that is an important argument. You know, conservation biologists have a lot of different ways to think about species. One of the most popular ideas is that of the keystone species, the species whose presence in its ecosystem provides opportunities for a host of other plants and animals and really holds the ecosystem together. The problem sort of with the argument you just made is that that's not true for every species. And again, the California gnatcatcher out in Southern California, or maybe even the southwestern willow flycatcher here along the Gila River, those species, it would surprise me greatly if we knew enough about them to know whether or not they were a primary ecosystem engineer. I don't think the California gnatcatcher was a primary ecosystem engineer. I think the California gnatcatcher, if it was removed from its ecosystem, and it has been removed from its ecosystem throughout most of Southern California, that ecosystem did not collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that you're required to make a utilitarian ecological argument for every species. I think that, again, for me, for those species that don't play a primary role in terms of the functionality of the ecosystem, that they still have an ethical right to continue their journey on the planet.
I agree. It just seems like if we let all these species go extinct, which we are doing right now, the sixth great extinction, that we're leaving an impoverished world for our children and grandchildren. And I think that's a concern. I mean, we've already lost so much. And we don't necessarily know what we've lost because it wasn't here when we were born. It was already lost before we showed up. But still, like you said, I think we do have an ethical obligation to save what we can, given that we've already lost so much. And that brings me back to threatened and endangered species in the valley.
Sure.
We've talked about southwest willow flycatchers a little bit and yellow-billed cuckoos. Haven't yellow-billed cuckoos just been uplisted to endangered or listed as a candidate species? I forget which one it is.
Well, they have been a candidate species for some time.
Okay.
And very recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed critical habitat designations for that species, although the species is expected to be listed soon. It hasn't been listed yet.
Okay.
But I personally remain hopeful that that species will receive federal protection in the near future.
And the critical habitat that they've proposed, is that in the Cliff Gila Valley along the river?
The Cliff Gila Valley is interesting in terms of critical habitat designations for riparian obligate songbirds in that when the southwestern willow flycatcher was federally listed, the Cliff Gila Valley was excluded because of the management plan that Freeport-McMoRan and their leasee, the Ubar Ranch, has put together. And so they felt that the bird had already, that there was a sufficient plan in place to secure that bird's future that they didn't need to give it the extra protection of critical habitat designation. So it was excluded. And they have proposed excluding the Cliff Gila Valley again from critical habitat designation for the western yellow-billed cuckoo, which I think the management efforts of Freeport and their leasee may provide the flycatcher and the cuckoo enough protections if everything else was the same. The problem is that everything else isn't the same. We have a critical threat from an Arizona Water Settlements Act potential diversion. And I think that the Fish and Wildlife Service needs to recognize that potential threat. And I think that critical habitat designation would ensure that federal agencies that are going to be responsible for reviewing that potential diversion are working under the obligations of critical habitat designation.
Yeah, well, we could spend a whole hour talking about the Arizona Water Settlements Act and a potential diversion. In fact, we have done that in the past, and it seems like it keeps coming up in a lot of these shows because it's going to impact so many different facets of our lives and of the valley. And for instance, the last time I did a show, I was talking with botanist Richard Felger about how a diversion would impact plant species in the valley. And so now here we are, it's coming up again. And we'll be talking about that some more right after we come back from a break. So stay with us, please. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program. And joining me here in the studio is ornithologist Mike Fugali. And we're talking about birds and ecosystems and habitats of the Cliff Gila Valley. Mike, I wanted to switch gears a little bit here and ask you a more personal question, how you became interested in birds in the first place.
Oh, gosh, let's see. Well, I grew up in Jamestown, New York, which was also the hometown of the famous 20th century birder Roger Torrey Peterson.
Huh.
And so my parents, you know, would take our family to the local Audubon Society or down to the local high school to listen to Mr. Peterson speak. And when I was growing up, he was my sort of idea of a celebrity.
Wow.
But still, I hadn't anticipated a life studying birds until I was in graduate school. And I was in Indiana University School of Public Affairs pursuing a double master's in environmental science and public affairs. And that was a program that was designed by Professor Emeritus Linton Caldwell to build this cadre of environmental specialists that could bridge the gap between science and policy. So it was really a policy wonk degree. But to get out of graduate school just a little bit earlier, I stayed a summer and I studied the reproductive ecology of wood thrush in the Hoosier National Forest. And I remember my first day out there, there was a professor that whipped a tape recorder out of his pocket. And he held it up to the trees and played the song of a worm-eating warbler. And out of nowhere, a worm-eating warbler came flying out of the trees and landed on a branch right above my head. And I was just amazed at the ability to communicate with these little neotropical migrants. And I threw away my suits and ties and became a field ornithologist. The rest is history.
A worm-eating warbler?
Yeah.
Wow. Do we have those here? I've never heard of one.
We do not. No, they're not. They're in the eastern part of the country.
Wow. So I know that a few years ago, you and your wife and some other volunteers were working on a program, which I think was called MAP, and I forget now what that stands for. And you were doing bird banding out in the valley. And what was that? What was the objective of that study, and what kinds of things did you learn from doing that work? And what was that work?
Right. That was a program out of the Institute for Bird Populations in California, and it was called MAPS, and the acronym stands for Monitoring Avian Productivity and Survivorship. And it was a demographic study of breeding bird populations throughout North America. So our MAP station was just one of thousands across the country. Hmm. They were trying to get a snapshot, and still are, trying to get a snapshot of the reproductive ecology of our breeding birds across the continent. And so what we would do is when we put out our nets and we captured birds, we were not only, you know, just putting bands on their legs, we were aging and sexing each individual bird. And so we were building demographic profiles for each species in the hopes of determining whether the station where we were located was in a source or a sink population. Sources and sinks are really important concepts for bird conservation. For instance, when I was working in Indiana with the wood thrush, the Shawnee National Forest next door in Illinois was a sink population for wood thrush. They had plenty of wood thrush over there, but every nest was filled with cowbird eggs. It was a highly fragmented forest, and so the birds were not replacing themselves successfully. Those birds were coming from somewhere else. And they hypothesized that perhaps they were coming from the Gila National Forest because the Gila National Forest had many fewer roads and was much more intact. And sure enough, I think that summer I found about 25 wood thrush nests. And I only had one nest that had one cowbird egg in it. All the other ones were filled with wood thrush eggs, and they were successfully reproducing in that area.
Can you tell our listeners what cowbirds do? Why they lay their eggs in other birds' nests?
Sure. Cowbirds are a nest parasite, so they've evolved a reproductive strategy of laying their eggs in the nests of other birds so that they don't have to stop and build a nest for themselves. They evolved in their native habitat is the Central Plains in North America. They used to think that the behavior evolved because they followed buffalo around and didn't have time to stop to build their own nests. That theory has been largely repealed because cowbirds, other species of cowbird throughout the world exhibit the same sort of parasitic behavior. Regardless, with human modifications to the landscape, cowbirds have spread across the continent, and they're coming into contact with a lot of birds that have no evolutionary history with them. And so they have developed no defense mechanisms. So in the Cliff Gila Valley, birds like the least bell or the Arizona Bell's Vireo and other riparian songbirds that build cup nests host a lot of cowbird eggs, and they feed a lot of cowbird nestlings to the detriment of their own young.
So they don't recognize that the cowbird isn't their own baby?
They don't. I saw a video recently of some work in Southern California with the least bell's Vireo, an endangered songbird, and they actually had video of a cowbird. Well, they used to think that cowbirds were very secretive. The female would come in and wait for just the right opportunity and then would slip onto the nest, quickly lay an egg, and slip away. But in this case, the video clearly showed that the cowbird came in and pushed the female off the nest. She sat in the nest and started laying an egg while both the male and the female vireo were excitedly flapping their wings and screaming above her head the whole time that she was on the nest. And it took her about 20 seconds to lay an egg, and she flew away. And then the female vireo looked down into the nest and waited about 10 seconds and then jumped on the cowbird egg and started incubating. She just didn't have the history, the evolutionary history, to be able to really identify that as a threat and a problem.
Wow. It's really hard not to have a value judgment about cowbirds. It seems like they're kind of gaming the system, you know, cheating and abandoning their offspring.
I know.
All the things that we disapprove of, you know, as humans.
It's particularly insidious out on these western riparian areas because the cowbird is an edge species. In long linear riparian corridors, are defined almost totally ass edge, and so cowbirds have access to most of those special songbirds in the cottonwood forest.
Yeah, so I think we kind of got off on cowbirds here, but I think my original question was about the threatened and endangered species in the valley. So we have the yellow-billed cuckoo and the southwestern willow flycatcher. And what else? What else is out there?
Well, we have a lot of riparian obligate species.
And what does that mean exactly?
Riparian obligates are songbirds that are obligated to nest or spend part of their life cycle in riparian forests.
Okay.
They don't have enough, they're not a generalist that can spread out across different habitat types. The riparian forest is their home, and it's what's necessary for them to survive.
Okay, so they're not like robins that pretty much live everywhere.
That's correct.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
And so, you know, in the Gila Valley, we have a number of species, like the summer tanager, the Sonoran yellow warbler, the Arizona Bell's vireo. The list really goes on and on. We have a lot of birds that occur there only because of that cottonwood forest that still persists in the valley.
So to get back to the issue of a diversion, if we had a diversion, what would happen to all those riparian obligate species? I mean, I know I'm sort of asking you to predict the future, which isn't exactly fair, but what's your best guess about how that would affect bird populations?
Well, if you're going to, and I think you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, but if you're going to think about the health of bird populations, particularly the riparian obligate birds that occur in the valley, you really have to think about the habitat itself. The habitat that still occurs there not because we've been particularly good managers throughout the 20th century. It occurs there because we failed to build a high-walled dam at some time in the 20th century. We luckily sneaked through the 20th century without a high-walled dam, and so we still have a natural hydrograph. The river still, for the most part, flows naturally and floods naturally. We do have the agricultural diversions that I mentioned earlier that particularly affect the base flow of the river, particularly in summer months. That is very, very, you know, harmful to in-channel communities of life, particularly fish and so forth. But there is also some benefit to the diversions in that you're taking water and you're increasing the residency time of the water in the floodplain by spilling it out, flood irrigating all these broad pastures. So instead of the water welling up and spreading out across the floodplain, recharging groundwater and supporting riparian communities, you have water moving inward from the outer edges of the floodplain, kind of creating a sponge effect. And so in terms of bird life, the riparian forests have maintained themselves pretty well, and a lot of those birds still persist. We have core populations of these endangered species. It's not like these birds are endangered in the Cliff Gila Valley. They're endangered throughout their range, but we have very, very steady, strong populations of these species in the Gila Valley. The problem is with a diversion, and it's very complicated, but it all comes down really to engineering. If we remove 10,000 acre feet of Gila River water annually, and we did it in a way where we could remove 350 cubic feet per second at any one time, which is how the program is designed. The problem is there's not very many times during the year when you can do that. 10,000 acre feet of water is not that much water, really, in terms of the annual flow of the Gila River. The problem is that you have to remove that water under very special conditions. Some proponents of the project would have you believe that most of those withdrawals would happen when the river is flowing really big.
Yeah.
And so you're just skimming off the tops of the big floods. So really, you know, what's the difference between a 30,000 cubic feet per second flood and a 29,650 cubic feet per
right.
second flood?
Right.
But unfortunately, that's not really where the water comes from. Modeling has been done using the rules of the CUFA agreements, showing that most of those withdrawals would have to occur when the river is flowing between 400 and 4,000 cubic feet per second. And most of those flows occur in the springtime during what's called the recession curve of the hydrograph. That's when the water is flowing at flood stage from snowmelt in the springtime, returning to base flow in the early summer. And it just so happens that those flows between 400 and 4,000 cubic feet per second, those are the ecologically critical flows for the development and maintenance of the riparian forests that these birds use.
I know that's a big topic, so let's talk about that a little bit more when we come back from the break. Stay with us, please, here on Earth Matters. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. If you're just joining us, my name is Donna Stevens. I'm the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and your host for today's program. With me here today in the studio is ornithologist and naturalist Mike Fugali. We're talking about the Cliff Gila Valley, the habitats, the birds, what a Gila River diversion would do to the ecology of the valley. And right before the break, we were talking about some of the kind of mid-sized floods that do a lot of work on the river. And those are floods that are between about 400 and 4,000 cubic feet per second. So those are the kind of more frequent spring runoff events. They're not the huge floods that are very dramatic and that, you know, we all like to go look at. Like, for instance, last September 2013, almost a year ago now, there was a flood that was about 30,000 cubic feet per second. So as we were saying, if you take some water off of that, take some water out of the river at that stage, it probably isn't that big of a deal. But that mostly aren't, those aren't the kinds of flows we're mostly looking at. Those are pretty rare. So what can you tell us, Mike, about the mid-sized flood events that are between 400 and 4,000 cubic feet per second?
Well, those floods are critically important ecologically. You know, I always say that the big floods, the really big ones, they set the stage for life. But it's those small to medium-sized floods that nourish the actors. It's those small to medium-sized floods that really are responsible for creating the opportunities for riparian plant germination. Those are the floods that allow those seedlings and saplings to survive. Those are the floods that spread nutrients across the floodplain. There's a whole suite of ecological processes that are created in the near channel area as a result of those small to medium-sized floods. And if you think about it, you know, it's those near channel habitats and the vigor of those near channel habitats that have to absorb over and over again the brunt of flood energy. And if there's not enough stem density or not enough roughness on the floodplain close to the channel, then you're setting yourself up for catastrophic scouring when the big flood finally does arrive. One cottonwood can't hold its ground, but 1,000 cottonwoods can. They work like an army to do battle with gravity.
Is that what you mean when you talk about channel roughness?
Yeah, channel roughness is the friction created by vegetation along the edges of the river corridor and in the near channel floodplain habitats.
So those are like the willows, for instance, that lie down and let the floodwaters just wash over them and they're perfectly fine with
right.
that?
Right. They capture incredible amounts of soil also. After a big flood, if you have an area of cobble created and you watch that for a decade and watch what happens in the absence of grazing pressure, it is a remarkable thing to observe. First, you get a whole bunch of annual species, many of them non-native, that just spring up along the river corridor. And then you have a small to medium-sized flood, and the friction of those grasses allow lots of soil deposition, creating those beds that then are germination sites for the cottonwood willows. So maybe in the first 2 or 3 years, you have a lot of herbaceous growth, and then you have a germination event, and then you have a stringer of cottonwood willows. And then if there's enough time between catastrophic flooding events, the next time you have a flood, the river those plants will be able to hold that soil in place, and the river might move up and around that stringer. It's almost like when it hits the front of that stringer, it's almost like hitting the bow of a ship. And so you'll get a new channel created on the far side of the stringer, and that's how the river is able to slowly move itself back and forth across the floodplain.
And it creates new habitats and new channels as it does that?
Right. And so if we diminished the amount of flooding in that 400 to 4,000 cubic feet per second range, what you would expect would be to have fewer germination events. You would expect to have a decrease in both the extent and duration of inundation on the floodplain, so there'd be less groundwater recharge. And most of these special birds that we were talking about, these riparian obligates, they really are looking for those low-temperature, high-humidity environments. Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of environments that are created. And I can't emphasize enough that it's created by the vegetation itself. It's the vegetation that is allowing the waters to well up and spread out across the floodplain. They are the ecosystem engineer that makes all those specialized habitats possible. And there's the idea of a threshold here, in that at some point, the vegetation has the upper hand, and it can successfully deal with flood energy. But when you decrease the amount of germination events and you decrease the overall vigor of those habitats by reducing inundation, reducing nutrient transport, reducing all those ecological processes that are connected to those small and medium-sized floods, then you risk going below that threshold where now the energy in the flowing water has the upper hand, and you've set yourself up for possible positive feedback episodes of catastrophic scouring.
What's so catastrophic about scouring?
Well, you know, a good example of catastrophic scouring is seen in the Gila Valley just below the two main agricultural diversions on the upper part of the Nature Conservancy's Gila River Farm property. There's about a quarter-mile section of floodplain that is completely treeless. And it's completely treeless because that is the area of the river corridor in the Cliff Gila Valley that goes dry almost every summer because all of the water is diverted into the irrigation ditches during the critically low-flow months of June and July. And so when we do have a germination event in that area, there's never enough water in the river or on the floodplain subsequently to allow those trees to mature and grow up successfully. They're always scoured away. What that's called is floodplain collapse. And so what it looks like is it looks like floodplains used to look like before woody vegetation evolved 250 million years ago. If you think what a broad alluvial river system would have looked like before trees evolved, and what the floodplain would have looked like, it would have been a very broad, very flat, very cobbly surface. And it's only by allowing the presence of those trees above a certain threshold of density that vegetation is successfully able to create conditions where life begets life.
So in that area at the Nature Conservancy's property there where you've said there's floodplain collapse, are there any birds living there?
Very few, because there's no trees living there.
Yeah, so there's really no reason for them to be there.
That's right. So certainly none of these special birds that we're most interested in.
Yeah. So the Interstate Stream Commission, the agency that is considering diverting the Gila River above the Cliff Gila Valley, has said a few times that diverting the Gila River would be a good thing because they would create a reservoir and then they could release water from that reservoir and put it back into the river at the dry parts of the year. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I just drove through Texas the other day, and I was listening to the radio, and I heard an old song on the radio. I think it was called "All That Glitters Is Not Gold," and it made me immediately think about this proposal from the ISC. The idea here is that if you created a reservoir of water and allowed that water to be used for irrigation in those critically dry summer months of June and July, then you could allow water to remain in the river so that base flows could be maintained instead of the river going dry. And the problem with that approach, there's many problems to that approach. Much of them are economic in the fact that agricultural users will probably never get their hands on that water. But beyond that, what this really is a Faustian bargain because you're pitting one section of the hydrograph against another. So by creating the diversion in the first place, you've harmed those critical flows in that 400 to 4,000 cubic feet per second range. But by storing that water, you're improving the base flow of the river. And so that does have some potential ecological benefits. It may benefit fish, for instance. It may benefit aquatic macroinvertebrates, all the things that actually need water perennially in the channel year-round. Mm-hmm. But it does nothing to replace those small to medium-sized flows. You're not mimicking flooding events. You're just putting a little bit more water in the river during base flow in June and July. And you're not going to be able to use that water to germinate riparian forest. You're not going to be able to use that water to transport nutrients across the floodplain. You're not going to be able to use that water to spread water out across the floodplain to recharge aquifers, et cetera.
Right. So you're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Exactly.
But you're not really even paying Paul very well, actually.
That's so. Right. It's a pretty measly amount of water to begin with. And, you know, there's two ways to address base flow issues. One is a very expensive way where you try to increase the supply of water through storage. The other more rational way to increase base flow would be to decrease demand by having more efficient agricultural systems.
Okay. So, Mike, I wanted to ask you just, we only have a couple minutes left,
sure.
But can you just tell our audience a little bit how the Gila River in New Mexico in the valley differs from it farther downstream, say in Arizona?
Sure. I think in general, we're very, very lucky in the Gila because despite stressors that humanity has placed on the river throughout the last century, we still are right on the edge of wilderness. And we still have at the top of the valley the natural flow coming from the mountains. We generally have enough water in the system to support agricultural uses and support a thriving ecological system. The further you move down into New Mexico and then into Arizona, the more stressors there are on the system. And so, for instance, in the Cliff Gila Valley, we have almost a purely native forest community. There's a little tiny bit of salt cedar. There's some Russian olive, but primarily it's a native forest community. When you get down into the Red Rock Valley or the Verdon Valley or in areas of Arizona, all that native vegetation is compromised, and you have huge, huge tracts of salt cedar. Generally, so much water has been removed from the system at that time that you have large stretches of the Gila River that go dry, every year. I remember reading somewhere where historically, people used to have to wait in their wagons for days before they could get across the Gila River just east of Phoenix. And that's no longer the case.
No kidding. I know in the years past I've heard you say that the Gila River is the last man standing, and I always thought that was a great quote. Well, I wanted to thank you so much, Mike, for joining me today to talk about the Gila Valley, the habitats, and wildlife. Thank you so much, and stay tuned next week, please.